Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a profile of Texas Governor Rick Perry, who has just entered the race for president, shaking up a crowded field of Republican candidates, none of whom have broken out of the pack, perhaps explaining why Perry is already considered a frontrunner. Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent James Moore, who has covered Texas politics for decades, joins us. Then political scientist Jonathan Wyler, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, joins us to discuss another frontrunner who has moved from the fringes of the mainstream to the mainstream of the Republican Party, Ron Paul. We will analyze the growing dominance of the right in American politics and how libertarian Ron Paul can at the same time appeal to both dope-smoking anti-war activists and anti-government gun lovers. Then finally, we will look into an article in Monday's New York Times that President Obama referred to, Stop Coddling the Super Rich, written by one of America's richest billionaires, Warren Buffett. Dr. Michael Krauss, lead author of a new study which finds that wealthy people are less empathetic, joins us to discuss why Warren Buffett is the exception to that rule. Joining us now is James Moore, who is the author of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, Bush's War for Re-Election, and the co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and author of Bush's War for Re-Election. An Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent, he has traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976 and just signed a contract for a new book on Texas Governor Rick Perry. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Moore.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, Ian.
And I get the impression that I talked to your colleague, by the way, earlier when about a week ago it was, I think, when Governor Perry had that big kind of political prayer kind of rally, that church and state mixture of activity in Houston. And Wayne sort of said that was a really well-organized event and it was very politically very savvy. And that's what keeps coming up all the time. People are suggesting that this guy is a very, very good politician, a good retail politician, and he's got a good team working for him. So what are his chances?
Well, I was at the prayer rally in Houston. I think I pretty much agree with Wayne's assessment. And the truth is that that was very calculated in a way in this sort of aspect that everybody's talking about in terms of dog whistle politics. This was Rick Perry saying, hey, all of you Christian fundamentalists, you evangelicals within the Republican Party, I'm not a Mormon. I'm just like you. By the way, did I mention I'm not a Mormon? And because Perry knows, as does everyone within the GOP, that being a Mormon is Mitt Romney's biggest challenge. And Perry doesn't want to make religion an issue in the primary, but he wants to make some distinctions. And that's an example to me of just how astute this guy is. I think I told you recently that he's probably the worst governor this state has ever had. Texas is, in spite of the myth that everybody's buying into in America, Texas is a train wreck. But nonetheless, Rick Perry is possibly the best politician that this state has produced since LBJ. I think his chances are very, very good. He's going to win. I think he wins the primary handily, and then he'll shift back to the center, and he'll talk about jobs over and over and over, and it's going to be a very, very difficult campaign for the president.
So how could it be that Texas is an economic train wreck, yet this guy is able to run, and apparently somebody's successfully convinced the mainstream press and the country at large that Texas is a great booming place with jobs.
We have jobs, but a lot of them are at Walmart and Carl's Jr., and many of the good jobs came with the stimulus package from the Obama administration that Rick Perry didn't want to have anything to do with. And yet, in a great gesture of duplicitousness, he accepted the money and it's helped. And in fact, he balanced his budget with Obama's stimulus package. And if he hadn't had that money, he wouldn't have been able to balance the budget. He would have been forced to increase taxes. But as it was, they are cutting about 100,000 teachers from payrolls. Most of the state agencies are being decimated, and institutional memory and ability is being cut loose with percentage cuts that range from 5 to 15%. Here's a perfect anecdotal story, I think, about where we are in Texas. While he was having his prayer rally with about 33,000 people and about 300 reporters, just down the road from there in Houston at the George R. Brown Convention Center, the Houston Independent School District was giving out little nylon backpacks with school supplies and fresh fruit and vegetables to underprivileged families. They expected maybe 5,000 people, and 100,000 people showed up and stood in the 100-degree temperature waiting to get in and get food and school supplies. That's not exactly a booming state when our biggest city is confronting issues like that.
So, James Moore, again, author of The Architect, Karl Rove, and The Dream of American Power, and you're also working on a new book about Governor Rick Perry. You've covered Texas politics for decades. What is explains what the man that you've written so much about, Karl Rove, on Fox, saying that he was worried that the candidates in the Republican Party were far too far to the right, and that they were in effect digging their own graves by pandering to the primary voters with right-wing rhetoric, and that they wouldn't be able to tack back to the center in the general. Does that problem apply to Perry? Because as far as I can tell, he's loaded with extreme right-wing baggage.
Yeah, I think that Rick Perry makes George W. Bush look like George McGovern. He is about as conservative a person as you would ever meet, and he has no compromise in him whatsoever. And he wants the Christian church involved in public life. He wants our schools to be privatized. He is against abortion, as you may or may not recall. One of the emergency measures that this guy brought to the forefront of his legislative agenda in a special session, the first thing he wanted voted on was a sonogram bill for women seeking abortions, which would require it, and then the doctor is required to ask them if they wish to see the sonogram, and then ask them if they want to hear the heartbeat. And the purpose of that bill is pretty obvious, and yet that was at the top of his list before he balanced the budget, before he figured out how to pay for schools. Now, this may be one of those rare moments, Ian, where Karl Rove and I are in complete agreement, and I think that if they get too far out to the fringe, they're going to have a hard time being taken seriously. But if Rick Perry chooses the vice presidential candidate to carry that Tea Party message, and he runs back to the center and talks jobs, 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 and every time Team Obama says, well, those are minimum wage jobs, Team Perry turns around and says the president is attacking the hardworking men and women of America, and that all work is honorable, and that kind of nonsense. So I think it can be done, but Rove is right. There's a great risk. But the truth is, the grassroots of the Republican Party has been surrendered to right-wing crazies, and they're going to choose the nomination. And Rick Perry has to make them happy if he wants to win it.
And this is the same Rick Perry that not so long ago supported Al Gore?
It's the same Rick Perry that supported Al Gore. It's the same Rick Perry who, supports subsidies for farmers and ranchers. It's that Rick Perry who used to be a relatively progressive Democrat when he came to Austin in 1985. It's him. And, everybody who has known him, myself included, since he first got to Austin, never would have envisioned that he is the ultra-conservative that he has become. He was a regular guy. He liked to hang out. He liked to talk politics. But he also doesn't like to lose. And He's won 9 straight elections. He's been in public office for 26 years, and his instincts are thus far flawless. He didn't, when everybody else was running away from the Tea Party, Rick Perry ran towards them. He embraced them. He put on his camouflage hat and went to their tax day rallies, and he was 25 points down to Kay Bailey Hutchison, who he was running against, a U.S. senator, in the GOP primary, and a week later, he's 10 points ahead of her. And he had an airplane flying over one of her political events, pulling a banner that said, Kay Bailout Hutchison, because she voted for the TARP bill. So, I mean, this is a guy who is brutal when it comes to politics. And I think that he's going to give the president a very difficult time.
So, but just to sort of interpret what you just said, James Moore, and by the way, I believe it was at that Tea Party rally that he talked about secession. Isn't this also a portrait of an extraordinary political opportunist? I mean, when did he have his road to Damascus conversion from being, you know, a supporter of Al Gore to being this hard right politician? Is it all about reading the tea leaves?
I think everything he's done has been about political expediency. I don't believe there was ever any sort of epiphanal moment for Rick Perry where he said, you know what, this doesn't fit with who I am. I think I'm going to go be a Republican. He was approached by Karl Rove, and Karl said, hey, come on over. We think we can help you and help your career. And in fact, he went from a relatively unknown West Texas state legislator to defeating a very popular populist Democrat who is ag commissioner in a statewide race with the help of Rove and conservative money.
Was that Jim Hightower?
Yes, that's Jim Hightower.
He defeated Jim Hightower.
He absolutely did.
Wow.
Rove used an FBI agent to launch an investigation of Hightower's office, and Perry was able to stand back and pretend he didn't know anything about it. And it led to indictments and controversy that got him the election. So it's, he saw opportunity on the right, but they have since split the sheets and gone their separate ways. Rove and the Bushes are not friends anymore.
Well, he's showing his skill as a politician by getting rid of the negatives right away. He's just announced that he thought it was a mistake for him to support the inoculation campaign against cervical cancer, which of course big government haters think is Orwellian, you know. So,
and the interesting thing about that, Ian, is that that was nothing more than helping out one of his political pals. Because
you mean the guy that owned the pharmaceutical company?
No, it was a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical company, Mike Toomey, who has been a big fundraiser and has set up a super PAC for Rick in the presidential race. And he wanted Mike to make a bunch of money off of the pharmaceutical company, so he put that in front of the legislature.
Mm. Well, I should not be surprised that politicians do that kind of thing, but somehow it always shocks me, James Moore. But how is Governor Perry going to get around? Presumably, let's assume for a minute that he makes it to become the nominee. In the general, how is he going to explain away his support, his feeling that the 16th and the 17th Amendments are unconstitutional and he doesn't believe in them, the 16th being federal taxation and the 17th being the popular election of U.S. senators, prior to which, of course, the passage of the 17th Amendment, state legislators elected senators, and that meant that whoever owned the legislature owned the senator.
I think that he's going to do what he did today in Iowa, which is I tried to bring this to attention of another reporter today. Perry is running around Iowa saying he loves America. And yet nobody has bothered to ask him, well, why in the hell did you want to secede from it then? The voting public has a short memory, and so do journalists. And let's hope that some of them confront him with these sorts of hypocrisies. He basically, you know, he talks about states' rights and says, you know, that everything belongs with the state, but then he talks about a federal constitutional amendment to put an end to abortion or to stop gay marriage, and so he's duplicitous in the extreme, and there's really no logical way to deal with that. But he's even begun to walk back his secessionist statement, and let's face it, the guy knew the audience. Again, this goes back to his political skills. He knew the audience he was to whom he was speaking. So you know, it was very easy for him to say that, and now he's been busy walking that back.
So does he have a foreign policy, James Moore?
No, I don't think he has a foreign policy to speak of. He doesn't have any foreign policy experience, and he was obviously not a good student when he was at Texas A&M University. So what he knows about the outside world, outside of the borders of Texas, probably isn't significantly different than what George Bush knew. And in that sense, I think Rick Perry is about as incurious as George Bush knows. If he has a foreign policy to speak of, it's related to the border. And, you know, he has sent money to the border to beef up law enforcement patrols. And, you know, a couple of the sheriffs that got that money to work on the improved patrols on the border and improved security ended up being on the take with drug cartels. So that backfired on them. And then, you know, we had these cameras that the state was beginning to fund that people were supposed to be able to log onto and watch for violators of the border. That was another big Perry thing, and it never worked. And so, you know, he just doesn't know in any sort of nuanced way, or maybe even in a very general way, about foreign policy. But I will say this: if you want a war with Iran, Electric Perry, and if you think we need to beef up our military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan and get on the ground in Libya and take Gaddafi out, then vote for Rick Perry. Because if everyone who thinks that our military presence and our foreign policy is presently too muscular is going to find it much more muscular if he becomes president.
So just in closing then, James Moore, what was the falling out with George W. Bush and Karl Rove? What happened there?
There were a couple of things, Ian. The first one was there was a vacancy in the United States Senate, and Perry wanted it, and Rove said no, and they gave it to someone else. And then in 1998, when Bush was running for re-election, Perry was in a tough race for lieutenant governor, and Perry wanted to go negative to save his skin in the race, and Roe wouldn't let him because, that drives down turnout, and they wanted to run up the numbers to make Bush look presidential, and Perry barely won. And after Bush left, Perry started making a few comments about Bush being neither a fiscal or a true social conservative, and he made public comments about it that were picked up by microphones, and the Bush family has sort of resented that. And then to top it all off, Karl Rove turned around and ran Kay Bailey Hutchison's race against Perry in the Republican primary. So that was pretty much the final nail in the coffin on that relationship.
Right, and Karl Rove doesn't like to lose.
Karl Rove has sort of been rendered irrelevant by this whole Perry thing.
And Bachman.
And
Ron Paul.
Let's at a minimum pray for an America that has Karl Rove irrelevant.
Well, on that note of qualified good news, I thank you for joining us, James Moore.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with James Moore, who's the author of The Architect Karl Rove and The Dream of Absolute Power, Bush's War for Re-Election. He's co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and author of Bush's War for Re-Election. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent and has traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976, and he's just signed a contract for a new book on Texas Governor Rick Perry. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the other surging Republican candidate for president, Ron Paul. Just like a miracle, you have to see to believe. 'Cause God bless Texas with his own hands, brought down angels from the promised land, gave them a place where they could dance. If you want to see heaven, brother, here's your chance. I've been sent to spread the message. God bless Texas. All my exes live in Texas, and Texas is a place I'd dearly love to be. But all my exes live in Texas, and that's why. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Jonathan Weiler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for the Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Weiler.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Jonathan, why do you think it is that we've been hearing so much in the last couple of days about the Iowa straw poll, with headline coverage of Michelle Bachmann's victory, and she won by 4,823 votes out of about 17,000 cast. Ron Paul came in second, only 152 votes behind her, and yet nobody pays any attention to the fact that he was a virtual tie with Bachmann for first place.
You know, it's been interesting with Ron Paul. Going back to 2008, I'm sure you remember at the end of 2007, he made headlines. He had that one-day money bomb where, you know, he raised like $4.5 million, and all of a sudden he seemed to be a surging challenger. And yet he's always been a marginal figure in the Republican Party. It's almost as if not only the party leadership doesn't know what to do with Ron Paul, but it also seems as if the media doesn't quite know what to do with Ron Paul, because he does fit less easily, I think, into our conservative and liberal categories than other people like Bachmann do. So I think that's at least one reason why he sort of gets ignored. I think people don't know quite what to make of him.
Well, there's also, I think, a tendency in the media to think that he doesn't have a chance of, you know, winning. They didn't think he'd win in Iowa, which he almost did. He won't win the nomination, and he certainly won't win the presidency.
Yeah, no, that is certainly true as well. And you know, I would say until probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, I don't think people would have taken Michelle Bachmann very seriously as a candidate either, although that clearly seems to be changing.
So you were at one of Ron Paul's rallies back in Iowa that in the last cycle, right, in
08? Yes, I was in Iowa in 2008, and one of the events I went to was a Ron Paul speech. And I have to say, Ian, it was one of the wackiest political events I've ever been to in my life. I mean, the sort of amalgamation of people there, from the 20-something hipsters who like Ron Paul because he favors legalizing medical marijuana, to the guys in their 60s and 70s dressed in military uniforms talking about how the United States has been ignoring the MIAs from Vietnam for 40 years. It was a bizarre gathering, and I think it adds to the point I made a couple of minutes ago, that people just don't quite know what to make of this guy, and it's really hard to sort of pin down what, if any, his base of support is. It just seems to be coming from a lot of very disparate directions.
Well, but, you know, that's one of the questions I have, is how does the libertarian Ron Paul at the same time appeal to both dope-smoking anti-war activists and anti-government gun lovers?
Yeah, and it's a good question. You know, I think part of Ron Paul's appeal, and I'm thinking a little bit about the event I saw that night in Iowa in January 2008, I think part of Ron Paul's appeal is that you do get the sense that what he believes, he's believed for a long time. He didn't just sort of fashion talking points to fit the latest news cycle. And so I do think, and I'm not saying that this is actually true, but I think that there's a sense of his authenticity that appeals to different kinds of people. And I think that's part of why you see him drawing support from sort of unusual and unusually disparate parts of the political spectrum.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Wyler, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. And, of course, he's a 12-term congressman from Texas, elected as a Republican, even though he is a libertarian and certainly doesn't shy away from that label.
Yeah.
He may be sort of, in a way, sort of exemplifying this paradox in American politics, where the largest political party in America is, in fact, I'm not one of the above.
You're right.
I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. You know, the country's full of recovering Democrats and recovering Republicans. That doesn't mean when you come to election time, they don't go back and vote for Tweedledum and Tweedledee. But
I think that's right. And to sort of amplify that point, Ian, I think that, you know, there's a tendency to, I think especially on the part of the media, to sort of mythologize the independent voter as a particularly sort of thoughtful voter, a voter that doesn't just sort of get sucked in by partisanship and slogans and really sort of takes her time to think about the issues and then settle on the candidate who best represents those. And the reality of independence, you know, for those who aren't obvious partisan leaners, and that is a lot of them, but the reality for independents is that their thinking on politics is really incoherent. It's just sort of all over the map, and it easily sways with sort of the time and the latest news cycle, et cetera. And so in that regard, you know, it makes some sense that a candidate who's really sort of himself, in some ways, all over the map on political issues, but gives voice to a certain kind of authentic American libertarian tradition, would appeal pretty broadly.
But I think the other point is, Jonathan Wyler, is that he runs as a Republican, not as a libertarian. If he switched parties, he'd be nowhere.
That's right.
And I just talked to some reporters before we went on the air down in Houston to try and get a handle on how he gets reelected all the time. And they say, well, he does great constituent service, even though he's anti-government. He was against hurricane relief because that's big government. You know, they had a big hurricane down there in Galveston. And
he was against swine flu vaccination in 2009 because that was a federal power grab.
Right, but at the same time, they took the hurricane relief money, the district. So it's sort of, to me, is a lesson for the futility, I think, of the third party on the left. You know, you'd be much better off taking over the corrupt shell of the Democratic Party than going off under the banner of the Greens or the Peace and Freedom Party, because you know, you'll get nowhere, just as Ron Paul. It's much cleverer to be run as a Republican than be run as a Libertarian.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, we should say, too, that despite the fact that Paul takes some positions that are, you know, not consistent with the mainstream of his own party, like he's against the Patriot Act and he's been, you know, very critical of U.S. involvement in Iraq and is generally sort of as a generally anti-Pentagon posture, that he has been rated by one very respectable rating system the most conservative member of Congress in the last 75 years. So, you know, he really does come by his conservatism quite honestly and unabashedly.
Well, if that conservatism includes smoking dope and being against the Afghan war, I'm not sure it does. But that, if that becomes a Republican issue, in terms of not so much the dope, legalizing marijuana, but getting out of these wars, that will be very interesting, don't you think, Jonathan? Particularly in a general election.
Yeah,
imagine
if it was
the Republicans who were anti-war, not the Democrats, because this is Obama's war now.
Yeah.
Even though it was Bush's, and you know, it'd be such a paradox to think that the Democrats become the party of war.
Well, and you know, Ian, we're really sort of being set up for that in a way by this whole super Congress that came out of the debt ceiling deal, right? Because one of the, you know, if the super Congress deadlocks and is unable to agree to $1.5 trillion in additional cuts, then one of the triggers is that there's supposed to be very significant additional cuts in Pentagon spending. And it's people like Leon Panetta and President Obama who have been saying in the last few days that those further cuts are unacceptable, that this super Congress needs to come to a deal so that doesn't happen. But I think you have to be dreaming to think that the Republicans and that super congressional committee or whatever it is would be more likely to agree to increase taxes than to accept those triggered Pentagon cuts. So, you know, I think that when Obama made this deal, he was gambling on the Republican Party being loath to agree to deep cuts in defense spending. And I think at this point, the Republican Party is much more doctrinaire about taxes, for example, very well exemplified, by the way, by Ron Paul's son, Rand Paul, who has himself made lots of statements about the need to cut Pentagon spending because it's contributing too much to our deficit. So I think the Republican Party in that regard, and how tactical it is and on principles, who knows, but in that regard, I think the Republican Party is going to have more interesting conflicts about the size of our Pentagon budget than the Democratic Party is, at least for the next year and a half.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Wyler, author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. Well, I think what you just told us, Jonathan, it was absolutely made clear at that debate that they had in Iowa early in the week, where they were asked if they'd take a 10-to-1 ratio of cuts to revenues, whether they'd find 10-to-1 acceptable, and not one of them did. I mean, they all, you know, I mean, that's shows you how far they've gone in this anti-tax, anti-revenue dogma.
And I suppose, you know, that's if there's one sort of claim to fame, if you will, within the Republican universe that Ron Paul really has, it's that he was sort of the first to this kind of position, right? Because he's been anti-tax and anti-federal spending for years and years and years before this became absolutely unshakable doctrine within the party. So he really has been an intellectual leader, if you can call it that, in that regard in his party.
So do you think that this peculiar combination of anti-war sort of social laissez-faire on the one hand, and you know, getting rid of Social Security and the more draconian right wing stuff that clearly give Ron Paul that rating that you said, where he gets the one of the top conservative ratings, is that likely to attract a younger generation of libertarians? I mean, there's always been people around that somehow find Ayn Rand interesting. But that's a kind of perennial fringe group. But I'm wondering whether there is more and more appeal. Because when Ron Paul asks for money, the money pours in. I mean, that's he does as good as Obama did back in 2008.
He is an amazing fundraiser, which really speaks to some very impressive intensity of support that he has. But you know, Ian, about your on your question, I guess I'm skeptical that these younger generations ultimately are going to go for a candidate like Ron Paul, because I think that in their mind, I think this is, you know, the flip side of Ron Paul being politically savvy enough to know that if he runs as a libertarian, he's completely marginal and irrelevant, and if he runs in the Republican Party, he has some political relevance. The flip side of that is that younger voters, especially voters under 30, I think are so turned off by the Republican Party and so turned off by, you know, their social conservatism, their intolerance. You know, Ron Paul himself, I know he's denied this, but he has a checkered past when it comes to race, especially in terms of this newsletter that he put out 20 years ago and some of the articles that were written there. And so speaking maybe not necessarily about Ron Paul specifically, but just about that kind of grouping of political positions, it's hard for me to see that somebody in the Republican Party will appeal broadly to voters under 30 who are really developing, as I said, a very strong antipathy to what they perceive as the party's general intolerance, really across the board. And I suppose, you know, moving away from sort of specific social issue positions, I think it's a broader intolerant disposition that's so troublesome to those younger voters. And the Republican Party is just not going to get away from that label for the foreseeable future.
Well, Ron Paul's son, Rand, made that extraordinary statement about why he opposed integration in the South, based upon the intrusion on the business owner who had the cafe that refused to allow blacks in, you know, that somehow by forcing that owner to integrate to his restaurant and to serve everybody that comes in the door, that was somehow infringing on this person's right to do business.
Their property rights and their
interests. Yeah, but it was totally devoid of any kind of historical or social or moral understanding of what civil rights was about. So,
absolutely. And it should be noted that Rand Paul got in a lot of trouble in early 2010 for making those comments, and you know, especially about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and his father, Ron, has the same position. He opposes the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So,
that won't make him unpopular with racists down in his district, I should think.
Again, in terms of the sort of general tendency to intolerance, as you and I have discussed previously, that's just so pervasive in the Republican Party now that's a label they're not gonna shake.
But it sort of is paradoxical for libertarianism, because libertarianism, I suppose, is ultimately about tolerance, isn't it? I mean,
well, you know, Ian, it's a really interesting question. I was thinking about that a little bit earlier. You know, libertarianism could certainly be coming from different kinds of psychological dispositions. And one could be exactly from what you said, a real laissez-faire, live and let live attitude. But it could also be coming from a place that says the world is a really messy, complicated place. And what we need are much more simple, clear principles to live by. And I think that kind of notion, this desperate need for things to be simpler than they really are, I do think is consistent on some deeper level with a kind of psychological intolerance, an aversion to a melting pot, multicultural society. So at least in some people's minds, it would make sense to me that a libertarian disposition and an intolerant disposition could in fact go together.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jonathan Weiler.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Wyler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He's the Director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about why the rich are not empathetic.
Don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive them old trucks. Let them be doctors and lawyers and such. Mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. They never stay home and they're always alone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dr. Michael W. Krauss, who is a postdoctoral fellow in psychology and medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. He is a social personality psychologist who focuses on how status, emotions, and the self shape interpersonal life. He is the lead author of a new study called Social Class as Culture, the Convergence of Resources and Rank in the Social Realm. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Krauss.
Thanks for having me.
And the New York Times, of course, has an article by Warren Buffett that's getting a lot of attention. Stop coddling the super rich. The President Obama referred to this article, which is actually dense in terms of its statistics and its research, all of which is pretty shocking. So I guess just off the top here, Michael, I know you're the lead author in a new study that finds wealthy people are less empathetic, but clearly Warren Buffett is the exception to that rule.
Certainly, and I think that a member of a self-proclaimed super-rich class saying the things that he's saying in this article, speaking against his own self-interest, is great for the overall well-being of the country. It also speaks to some of the future research that, as psychologists, we can do. For example, in our studies, a lot of times we don't get corporate CEOs in our research to take part in our samples and our experiments. So we know very little about the context in which this sort of talk about your own self-interest against those self-interests would originate in someone like Warren Buffett, who's clearly, you know, speaking on behalf of everyday working class Americans.
So, but just to go back to your study then, I take it in broad sense, it finds that the rich really are different. I mean, that's that famous line from Scott Fitzgerald. And what is it, their life experience that makes them less empathetic, less altruistic, and generally more selfish?
That's right. In essence, what we find is, you know, being a person of wealth, being a person of educational accomplishment, makes you really goal-oriented, makes you really self-focused on your own interests, on your own rewards. And in some cases, not on all cases, but in some cases, that can be bad for your personal relational well-being. So in terms of, you know, helping a stranger, we find that wealthier individuals are less likely to help and help for less amounts of time in the laboratory. They're also less good at reading others' emotional expressions in live interactions and also when reading people's facial expressions. And then finally, more disengaged interactions. So when two people are strangers and they're talking for the first time, people from wealthier families tend to be more disengaged. They'll go to their cell phone and check the time, for example, during that interaction, more so than someone with less education and income.
So the current philosophical and political battles over economics and taxes and the debt ceiling and defaulting and the stock market, et cetera. I take it your study finds that that is partly rooted in the upper class ideology of self-interest.
So that's a possibility, an extension of our work, that you know some of these self-interested interpersonal motivations that are characteristic of the participants in our samples may, in fact, carry over into social policies, economic policies that are self-interested as well, right? So policies that would say, for example, don't tax the job creators would be an example of a sort of a self-interested policy.
Well, that's become the new word for a billionaire, isn't it? A job creator.
Right. It's in some ways, I would say it's true. But the question then is, does taxation reduce job creation? And in Warren Buffett's article, he says emphatically no.
Well, but I understand your study, again, social classes, culture, the convergence of resources and rank in the social realm that you have, were the lead author on, Dr. Michael Krauss, that it finds that rich people believe that economic success and political outcomes and personal outcomes have to do with individual behavior, like a good work ethic. They just gloss over the ways that family connections, money, and education helped. And I suppose that enables them to denigrate the role of government and oppose taxes to fund it.
Right, yeah. It's very possible that those sorts of explanations for everyday success, right, those I achieve success and failure befalls me, because of my own hard work and talent and not because of, you know, political opportunities. Yes, that's in fact what we find in some of our studies.
So the general public is troubled by the disparity in wealth and the growing disparity in wealth. And I'm wondering where we are in terms, I mean, some people say we're at another gilded age. Where do you think it, in terms of the feedback that you got, we are, in the sense that to be, I'm thinking of Gordon Gekko in that film Wall Street, where you can publicly say greed is good, or quote the Tea Party hero Ayn Rand, who said it is the morality of altruism that men have to reject.
Right. So I think we're in the very beginning stages, shifting stages of a class sort of wake up call. I think the debate has shifted towards, you know, recognizing that some of the biggest issues of our time now are in the unequal distribution of wealth in society. Now, that's not without its challenges. And there was a study, for example, by Mike Norton at Harvard Business School that found that people are unhappy with inequality. So that's good. But they're also woefully unaware of how great inequality is in American society. So,
by the way, the rich themselves don't realize they're rich. That was a recent study, wasn't it?
Right. So there's really a sort of a disconnect between, you know, gosh, inequality is really bad on the one hand, but then I'm not really sure how bad the problem is. And the more I think we talk and debate about these issues and people like Warren Buffett stand up and say, you know, I want to do my fair share in terms of taxation, the more we can shift the debate and get the real facts about how grossly unequal wealth is in American society.
Well, Dr. Michael Krauss, the extent to which we are at a let them eat cake moment, I think, is indicated by the booming sale in luxury goods. I did an interview a while back with people in marketing who study marketing, who said that that now there's a tremendous swing towards advertising for luxury goods, and not for the sort of middle-class American dream, which was originally the core of all advertising revenue, was to sell as much to as many. Now it's to sell incredibly expensive things to a few.
Yeah, that's a let them eat cake moment is a fine way of explaining that. I was aware of that, I think maybe a week ago, and really shocked to see that sort of increase in luxury goods sales is an indicator, I suppose, that things may get worse before they get better.
Well, we know that over 80% of the nation's wealth is controlled by 20% of the people, and then a vast percentage is controlled by the 1%.
Right.
But let's talk about some of the examples that you have, you know, empirically proved, as opposed to what our opinions. You know, I tend to be try to deal with facts, but opinions often get in the way.
Certainly.
So tell me about the one of the tests that you did where you had 115 people play the dictator game.
Right. So the dictator game is this game developed by economists. What you do is you give people basically an economic windfall. So I say I give a person $10 in the laboratory, and I say, you know, you've got this partner. They're in another room. In the study, you've never met them before, you will not meet them today. But I want you to go ahead and give as much or as little as you want of this $10 to this anonymous person who you'll never meet. It is a single trial, and it's thought of by psychologists as this really solid trait measure of how generous you are in general. What we find is people who are lower in socioeconomic status, so they feel like they're lower in terms of their own income, education, occupation status, they tend to give around 30% more of this economic windfall to this anonymous person who they won't meet and did not meet in the first place. So it's really this laboratory test of your sort of overall generosity that we find that people who tend to be lower in social class are doing it more.
And tell us about the other study that you conducted where you studied the vagus nerve reaction showing your guinea pigs or the respondents pictures of starving children.
Right. So this is work primarily done by my colleague, Dacher Keltner. But what happens is he shows everyday students from various social class backgrounds whose parents are wealthy or less wealthy. He shows them these videotapes that are really evocative of the suffering of others. So one of the tapes, for example, is children who are who have cancer and they're terminal, and you see the suffering that these kids are experiencing on a daily basis at the hospital. So everybody sees these videotapes, and then some people show physiological responses more than others. And what we've found in some of this work is that people from families that are lower in socioeconomic status tend to show this reduction in heart rate during these interactions that is consistent, while they're watching these videotapes, that is consistent with this sort of orienting response that you're seeing these people suffering on the videos, and you're sort of marshaling up, cooling your nervous system and marshaling up a tendency to help other people. And so we've seen that for people with lower socioeconomic backgrounds more so than their upper class counterparts.
Well, just in the last minute then, how did you ever get any kind of response to find out this thing that puzzles me as a kind of observer of politics, why so many Tea Party people who, you know, the Tea Party is largely funded by the wealthy, they are not themselves wealthy. So I'm just trying to understand how people could think that by giving a billionaire a tax break, somehow that'll make you better off.
Right. So that is a puzzle. And it's some of our future work needs to examine how sort of the other-oriented nature that we find is a part of a person from a lower-class background who needs to depend on other people and use their resources collectively to help others. How that can lead, in some cases, to agreement with authority figures, to justification of the current social structure and the justification of the current leadership.
Well, let's revisit that discussion later when you do more research, because I'd love an answer to that. I thank you for joining us, Dr. Michael Krauss. Again, he is the lead author of a new study called Social Classes, Culture, the Convergence of Resource and Rank in the Social Realm. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about Rick Perry, who's just entered the race. We talked with somebody who's known him and covered him for years down in Texas, Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent James Moore, who's covered Texas politics for decades. He's actually writing a book about Perry at the moment. And he truly is a man with no principles, a complete political chameleon. He started out supporting Al Gore. He basically realized that the country is moving to the right and Texas is moving to the extreme right. And the more right-wing he was, he became the better off he was. And indeed, he proved that when he ran against Kay Bailey Hutchison in the recent race for governor. She was the anointed candidate. Her campaign manager was Karl Rove. Perry jumped on the Tea Party bandwagon and beat her. Now that he's become a national candidate, he's got to figure out how to win the Republican primary, at the same time be electable. And already Karl Rove is saying that these people like Perry, he didn't say name him, of course, he didn't name Bachman, but he's suggesting that the party is going to have problems with candidates that are so far out there on the right. But on the other hand, the country appears to be moving so far to the right, he is electable. Then we talked about the other candidate who's out there that's doing well. And that is, of course, Ron Paul. Jonathan Weiler, who wrote Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, joined us. And Paul, you know, he came within a hair's breadth of beating Bachman in the Iowa straw poll, but got no publicity. I mean, she stole all the headlines. So there's something going on that people don't recognize, particularly the press, I think, don't recognize the phenomenon that Ron Paul is. He's also a fundraising phenomenon. He just makes tons and tons of money over the internet. People really willingly give up money to a politician, which is a rare thing. So there's a lot more to be done to understand him. Although Jonathan Weiler pointed out that there's some extreme negatives about him, his racist past, and not to mention his son's weird objections to the Civil Rights Act based upon property rights. They're certainly out there on the fringe, but they're becoming mainstream, and it's amazing to think that that's what's happening. Then we finally spoke with Dr. Michael Krauss about a study that he did about the rich not being empathetic, and it ties in, of course, to an article in the New York Times by one of America's richest people, Warren Buffett. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.